Thanks, Brian.
Listen, I screamed at you twice today and you didn't even hear me. I just started to pick it up. Okay, the Committee on Consumer Business Affairs will come to order and we will turn to House Bill 2647 and ask President Bowe to be our first witness.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. I just briefly want to express some of the concerns that I have with this concept that you're dealing with in this bill. We all know time is getting short. I think the House has done a rather workmanlike job on this bill with the time and the other restrictions that they have had on them. I don't think it's the final answer to the problem that we have in malpractice. I'm not sure we'll ever get to one. In the last 2 weeks, a concept has occurred to me that we've been doing some work on, but it's far too complex to go into in this time of the session. But this bill does make reference and make provision for interim study on this particular subject. And just for your own information, the concept that I'm working with is a degree of malpractice or degrees of malpractice. We've had legislative counsel research this, and so far we can find no other state that has attempted this way. But I would very much, in the interim period, like to pursue this. I think it maybe there's some grounds for some fruitful discussion. If, just for example, we had 3 degrees of malpractice, as we used to have in murder, for example, the degrees of murder, we had malpractice 1, a malpractice 2, and a malpractice 3 categories. This could be defined by malpractice 1 being gross negligence, malpractice 2 something lesser than that, and malpractice 3 something else. And then with that, circumscribe fiscal limitations into these degrees of malpractice. Just to pick some figures without having really thought them through very carefully, malpractice 3 would be $25,000 or less. Malpractice 2 from $25,000 to $150,000. Malpractice 1, for the gross negligence, the sky would be it would be as it is now. But it would be then incumbent upon the attorney and his client to sit down and to make a very realistic assessment before they plugged into the system of just how much damage has been done. Was it a sponge that was left in the incision? That was a rather simple thing to get out. Some other simple matter of malpractice. It would then become incumbent upon the attorney and his client to decide where they would plug in. Is it malpractice 1, 2, or 3? And I think it would have a very definite force on the attorney and his client to make a realistic assessment of the true damages that have been that have occurred in this matter. I think the concept bears some thought and some study that I hope it will be given in the interim. But I also want to tell you that I think it's extremely important that this session of the legislature address this problem in the best way that we can now and pass a bill that does have some limitation and some fiscal responsibility in this matter of medical malpractice. You're all aware, I know, of what's been happening in California. It's now spreading to Southern and Northern California, spreading to Southern California, to the Southern states, where we find physicians going on strike simply because they choose not to endanger their life's earnings, their potential life's earnings, simply because they can't get malpractice or refuse to pay the tremendous sums of money that are necessary for them to receive this type of insurance. And so I know all of us are getting very, very tired, and it's getting towards the end of the session, but I would ask you to give this bill 2647 with whatever modifications you feel are necessary to improve the bill very serious and earnest consideration, and expedite it to the very best of your ability, consistent with good sound thought and reasoning, so that we can get a bill, if there are changes, that it can get back to the House, give them a chance to concur, or to have a conference committee appointed in order to give at least the beginning resolution of this most serious problem that I think that we face in the state of Oregon with regard to the delivery of medical services. thank you very much for your time. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have.
Committee have questions of President Bowe? Senator Burby.
With what you told us about an interim committee study, would you suggest possibly that what may be arrived at is some kind of an agreement of the committee that could go to the floor, that there be a date put on the legislation that's offered to the legislature?
I haven't thought of that. I don't think that, due to the volatility of the subject, and also for the, I would imagine, for the sake of the insurers that will be underwriting potential losses, I'm not sure that would be the way to go. It's a subject I'm sure the committee will want to pursue, whether they want a self-destruct clause, but to self-destruct strikes me that nobody will really think there's been a solution made to it. I'm not sure that you would want that on the bill. I think the bill will self-destruct when a better solution is in hand, I think, and it will self-destruct automatically at the next session if and when we can come up with better answers for the problem than we're able to achieve this session. But I think it's highly important that we achieve an answer, even if it's not the best of all possible answers, this session.
Other questions from the committee?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, President Bowe. I'd ask Representative Stultz to be the next witness so that he can take us through the bill and maybe prepare us for the testimony that follows, since it came from committee. Representative Stultz serves on in the House.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bob Stultz, and I'm state representative from District 45, which basically is central Douglas County. I'm serving as vice chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, where House Bill 2647 was amended and passed out to the House floor in the form that it now comes to the Senate. In our testimony before the House in consideration of this bill, which was originally the OMA bill, we found that certainly a situation has arisen which is volatile, at least, and one which perhaps will have, unless something is done to correct it, will have a great impact upon the health facilities of the state of Oregon and upon the medical profession generally. In an attempt to come up with a bill of this sort, I think all of you people who have served in the legislature realize that it's been necessary that there be a system whereby things were put into the bill and things were taken out by way of compromise, and yet I think that our committee at least kept in view the problems which are apparent to us at this time and tried, within our limited capacity at least, to arrive at a compromise type of a decision in putting this bill out, which we think hopefully will be effective to the problems that we face. You'll hear other testimony and other evidence here in respect to what has created the problem, and I don't want to go into it to any great extent. I do want to mention that at the present time there are two insurers who are operating in the medical malpractice field in Oregon. One of them writes about 25% of the medical coverage, and we understand has indicated that they will put limitations upon their type of coverage which will not be acceptable to the insurance commissioner, and probably that company will be out of business soon as far as medical malpractice in Oregon is concerned. The other company, the one writing the majority of the malpractice insurance, has a contract which runs until April 1, 1976, with no requirement that there be an extension beyond that time, and there has been every indication that unless the problem is relieved as far as awards, the multi-million dollar type of awards, that they will withdraw from the market in Oregon and leave us without the type of protection which I think is absolutely paramount for a helpful medical practice and society in Oregon. And I want to go through the bill with you, sort of a section by section or a page by page, if I may do that, and speak only to those things which we felt at least were important, and I know that there will be people who disagree with our decisions who will have amendments for the bill. I assume that the Medical Association itself will have, probably plaintiff's attorneys and perhaps defense attorneys and maybe just the public sector in lots of areas. But as I say, this bit measure is a result of compromise, and in that spirit, I think it should be said that the first portion of the bill was generally an adoption of the proposals of the Oregon Medical Association in connection with giving them some tools to better police their own profession and to perhaps remove from their profession some of the people, or at least give them authority to remove some of the people who have been causing some of the problems which are inherent, I think, within the malpractice area. You'll note that on page 3 of the bill, the definitions have been increased, particularly the definition in respect to unprofessional and dishonorable conduct. And a particular reason that area has been expanded is because that is one of the reasons unprofessional and dishonorable conduct, which is now within the statute, which will permit the medical society to take action against its own members. And this expanded definition, I think, gives them latitude and ammunition that they have not had in the past. You'll note at the bottom of the page that the board may suspend or revoke a license to practice medicine in this state for any of the following reasons, and then there are set out 23 of which are existing, but the first one, the unprofessional and dishonorable conduct, has been expanded by the language on page 3 just above the unprofessional or dishonorable conduct reference, or the section 1A reference, and it's that material contained in section 1 of the bill. There were some additional language added to the number 15 specification for suspension or revocation, which previously spoke just to gross negligence, but added to that is repeated negligence, and that of course is for the purpose of getting at the repeater. On
Bob, you don't mean the repeated gross negligence?
No, the repeated negligence.
Less than gross negligence.
Yes. A situation, and I think probably it has occurred, where one doctor has been subject to a number of suits. And under the existing law, the medical society itself cannot reach that person under any of the present provisions.
Could I inquire what you mean by repeated? Twice? Three times?
Well, I would prefer, Madam Chairman, I suppose in the committee of seven, there may have been seven different ideas, and in the courts they very well may be. But I would prefer that question be directed to a representative of the medical society, because they were the ones who were responsible for this language to begin with.
We've noted in Judiciary Committee that the courts interpret frequent as once. So maybe we ought to put frequent here instead of repeated.
I don't know whether they want...
I say that for Senator Brown.
I don't know whether they want to go to the extent of being able to act against someone for one occurrence of ordinary negligence. Gross negligence, of course, is, at least the lawyer members, and perhaps all of you know, is defined within the case law. And I don't think that one would create any particular problem, but perhaps a matter of repeated negligence would mean at least twice, and from there on, I suppose it's anybody's ball game. One of the new additions to the basis for the suspension or revocation of the licenses appears on page 5, and that is the specification which says that refusing invitation for an informal interview with the board requested under section 3C, which is the following section, gives that ground then to the board to act. It's obviously a mechanism whereby they can talk with the doctor and try to determine what the problems are. And under the existing law, they can request them to come in for an interview, but there's really no sanctions to be applied to them if they don't. In connection with the action that the association can take, we're providing, and at the association's suggestion, that they may be able to place a limitation on his license to practice medicine within the state. And then, in addition, the action authorized, the board may temporarily suspend the license of a physician without a hearing. Simultaneously, and with the commencement of proceedings under the statutes, if a board finds evidence in its possession that indicates a physician's continuation in practice constitutes an immediate danger to the public. Again, that gives them an opportunity of moving quickly if it's indicated that such movement should be made, but it still at the same time protects the physician because of the necessity that further board action must be taken against him, and that the elements of due process then enter in connection with the hearing.
Can I stop you there?
Certainly.
Is the suspension under the APA so that we ought to say, notwithstanding something or other in Chapter 83?
I believe it was within our contemplation that the procedure be in connection with the APA. But again, perhaps I'd better leave that to the people who were the drafters.
Okay.
There is a new language appearing on page 7, which generally speak to the action of the board itself and to the rights of the physician in respect to alleged violations. And again, I think this will be covered substantially by the people who are to follow me. We have in here a mechanism which I think we're familiar with in connection with traffic laws, and particularly in respect to driver's license and things of that sort, and I refer to it as an implied consent feature. And that appears in subsection 3 of section 3D on page 8, which provides that any person licensed to practice medicine in this state shall, by so practicing or by filing an annual registration to practice medicine, be deemed to have given his consent to submit to a mental or physical examination when so directed by the board, and further to have waived all objections to the admissibility of information derived from such mental or physical or medical competency examination on the grounds of privileged communications. And again, it's a mechanism, certainly from a doctor's standpoint, whereby they can try to get to the core of the problem as far as their own practitioners are concerned. Now, realizing that this by itself and some of the things that we have done that I'll speak to later in respect to the problems of limiting awards and speaking to certain evidentiary matters may not be sufficient to keep the medical malpractice carriers in the field, we have, beginning with section 5, in section 5, We have spoken to the duty of the present underwriters to report to the medical board those instances where claims are made against their insureds, and to provide information in respect to the awards and the settlements of cases and the determination and facts relating to those claims. So again, that the medical association can have the information at hand, which is important to it in making determinations about whether to take action in respect to a licensed physician. It also provides that members who are licensed are required to make reports of instances which come to their knowledge in respect to malpractice or to incompetency within a particular profession. And again, for the purpose of beefing up the board's authority and policing their own ranks. We do provide, in respect to the medical review committee, that the information that they have is confidential and that they cannot be required to reveal that in subsequent proceedings which may arise. Section 9 speaks very briefly to just one problem, and that's the Kaiser Hospital plan. And rather than taking the entire area out and saying that the only remedy, of course, is the action for medical malpractice, this recognizes the fact that Kaiser, and perhaps there will be others, who have within their medical contracts a provision for arbitration. And that's a contract between the medical practitioner and the health plan people. And this bill would continue the authority for them to approach those problems by arbitration if there were any question about whether they should or shouldn't do it. Now, in speaking to the problem itself, and I got ahead of myself a little while ago, starting to speak about the insurance thing or the absence of insurance, but first, before getting to that, and speaking to the actual lawsuit, the medical malpractice lawsuit, we heard a number of suggestions and a number of ideas about what actually was causing the problem. And in an attempt to address those, we did make some changes, some of them perhaps more cosmetic than realistic. There was concern that the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur would be extended, and apparently it has been in some states. We have the doctrine, I think, clearly outlined by case law in the state of Oregon, and to make sure that there was not an improper extension of it, we have provided by statute in Section 10 the set out in statute the present doctrine of res ipsa loquitur and have set forth how it should be applied. I want you to be sure that it's our understanding, at least in House Judiciary, that this is no change in the existing case law at the present time. Now, we also have the locale rule, which is one that we've heard problems concerning, saying that testimony has been received in respect to the usual practices in areas other than the state of Oregon or in areas other than where the particular treatment occurred and from which the alleged malpractice has arisen. In Section 11, we speak to that and provide that any physician licensed to practice medicine by the Board of Examiners of the State of Oregon shall not be liable to a patient or any other person in connection with the treatment of a patient, providing the physician follows the standards of practice of ordinarily careful physicians under the same or similar circumstances in the same or similar community in the State of Oregon. And that used to be the case law. I'm not sure that it is at the moment, whether it's been expanded extensively here or not, but it is certainly an attempt to keep it from being expanded beyond that particular definition. Informed consent was another area which has created concern in the medical profession itself, and I'm sure that there will be some amendments proposed here, because I feel that the profession does not feel that we've gone far enough in limiting or in speaking to the problem of informed consent. But what we have done is what we thought was practical at this time, and again, in Section 12, we provided a physician licensed to practice by the Board of Examiners of the State of Oregon has a duty to warn his patient of all material risks inherent in a proposed course of treatment and of all the feasible alternative courses of treatment available, unless in the reasonable exercise of his, the physician's, professional judgment, to so warn or advise would be detrimental to the patient's well-being. And then we provided a risk is material if the result might well occur, or the result that may occur is of serious consequences unless the likelihood of the result occurring is remote. again, I think that's pretty close to case law again, but perhaps not as strong as the medical profession feels that it should be. Then, of course...
Bob, why do you think you have to put all this stuff in that's already in case law? If it's,
because of the concern, and we're speaking, I think, Madam Chairman, to the concern of the insurers that these doctrines are going to be expanded, as they have been in some states under case law. Pardon?
What leads you to believe that? What cases have there been that expanded them?
Our testimony has been that in some jurisdictions, California in particular, there's been an expansion in recent years of it. I don't think there has been that tendency in Oregon at this time to expand. But one of our purposes, very frankly, in drawing this bill, was to put those things in it which we felt would encourage the insurers to stay in the market in Oregon, without at the same time taking away from the injured patient a right of action, and trying to maintain the law basically as it is in Oregon, except as to the amount, total amount of the awards and the attorney's fees, which I'll get to in a moment. But that really was our concern. Our attempt was to satisfy, hopefully, the concern of the insurers. And I think they have been generally pretty candid that their real concern is over the huge verdicts which have come in some other areas, and perhaps not so much in Oregon at this time. I think you'll hear testimony that there has been one verdict of $500,000, and that would be the top one in Oregon. Speaking to the matter of the award itself, it was a decision of the committee that the award should be limited to the sum of $400,000, which would include both general and special damages. Now, the contingent fee has been pointed out. I think maybe it's been more popular with the editorial writers than it has with the witnesses, which appeared before the committee as a cause for the fact that only a minor portion of the malpractice premium reaches the injured person. But there has been that concern about the contingent fee situation, and we have approached it on the basis that in addition to the award, with the top limits of $400,000, there shall be allowed to a prevailing plaintiff a reasonable attorney's fee to be determined by the court. We have not put any limitation in respect to the court's determination, nor do I think we should, as to what's reasonable under the circumstances. I can certainly foresee that perhaps on small awards that a reasonable attorney fee would equal or perhaps be in excess of the amount of the award, depending upon the showing that the attorney is able to make about the time expended and the usual things which go into a determination of reasonable attorney's fee. But I also feel that in the upper limits of the limitation, that the attorney generally would have difficulty in establishing the reasonableness of an attorney's fee, which would be equivalent to 40% of a $400,000 award, for instance.
What was the thinking of the House Committee when they amended out the economic loss provision?
Well, this was one of the compromises, I suppose, that we made, that some of the members are adamant that economic loss was not sufficient as far as an award was concerned. And I can envision a situation where it might be acceptable to this committee, certainly, to work with the problem of economic loss and then some additional compensation for future lost earnings and for pain and suffering, things of that sort, which generally go in to make up general damages in the case. But they're, very frankly, we at times came up with very very interesting coalitions within the 7-member committee that we had to get 4 votes to put this bill together, and it's actually the way that it was done. In all candor, I couldn't tell you it was
political,
done any
not
other
rational.
Way.
Okay.
Right. Okay, getting by that, and that's as far as we've spoken to the award. They put a limitation on, speak to attorney's fees, codify some of the case law and see what happens, I guess. If it isn't sufficient to keep the insurers in Oregon, we have provided, and that's what I started to speak about a while ago and a little bit out of turn, provided that the medical profession could establish its own reciprocal insurance company and reinsure in sum sufficient to take care of the problems within the limitations that we've placed in the bill. I think this is certainly Mr. Rawls had some input in connection with that. There's been substantial study in respect to the efficacy of going in this direction, and I think probably we'll all agree that if there isn't available in the open market medical malpractice insurance, the physicians are going to have to do something in that order. This is the machinery which we envision would be appropriate for it to go in that direction. Now, and additionally, as the last item in connection with the bill, Senator Bow spoke about the provisions for an interim study. And this is to relate, as we envision it, not only to medical malpractice, but to all professional malpractice. Those of you who are lawyers understand what are happening to the lawyers in respect to their malpractice. The same situation, I understand, is arising with architects and engineers and dentists and other professional people. And we would hope that when the study is made, it would not just be limited to the medical field, although that is the most urgent one perhaps at this moment. I think generally I've highlighted what we have done, and I hope I've given you some understanding of why we have done some of the things that we have. I'm sure that you'll hear testimony in all this from largely a lot of the same witnesses that we did, and with Senator Bow, although I'm not sure the medical profession likes to have the comparison made between murder in the first, second, and third degree and what doctors do on occasion. I hope that you will recognize the urgency of the situation and that we can get a bill which will be helpful to Oregon, at least in the interim, until we're able to develop a study as to what in finality should be done. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Bob. Questions from Representative Schultz?
So are you an attorney?
Yes, I am.
If I might ask an in-house question then. Is it reasonable to assume that reasonable attorney fees can be derived after the settlement in a malpractice case? Is it difficult? Do you have trouble practicing attorneys who agree with the settlements more than not?
No. To answer your last question first, I don't think they disagree more than they agree. The final authority, of course, is placed in the court, and it becomes incumbent upon the attorney who anticipates that he's going to have to establish the reasonableness of his fee to do a workmanlike job of keeping track of his time and effort. And it places an additional burden on the attorney, certainly. I didn't mention, but I think it's implicit in what I did say, that we provide that irrespective of any contract between the attorney and the injured person, the only fee that the attorney is to get is a reasonable fee established by the court.
Other questions? Senator Hart. Well, the
country is closed. The physician must tell the patient all the ramifications. I went through this bill two or three times with the doctor, and he sat there and told me what was going to happen and what the chances were and everything. And just he and I were alone in the room. Once you get to the who's going to prove what the doctor talked over with the patient, unless you have a state recording system or some other thing that get the court, I'm sure that when I had the argument with, he would tell me, he didn't tell me what he did, and I'd say what he did. it's up to the, I can see where a woman is there and the nerve nurse must be present what would they do?
Well, Senator, it's a problem of proof under any circumstances. A plaintiff has to bear the burden of the proof in the case, and I recognize it's a different field, a difficult field. I think the medical profession feels that this is too heavy a burden on them the way that it's written here. But maybe to answer your question, how are you going to do it? I suppose the profession's either going to have somebody present, or they're going to have to, as you suggested, tape record their conversations. And these are real mechanical problems, and I realize that they're there.
Okay.
Other questions of Representative Stoltz?
Thank you very much.
Appreciate you taking the time.
Glad to do it.
We have some other legislators in the room. Let me ask if you'd like to testify. Representative Probemeyer, you've been here since we began.
He's here for a moment. I think Representative Kulongoski comes from another hearing.
Okay. Representative Kulongoski and Representative Ferguson. You're going to let him go first?
Okay. He'll talk a little longer.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ted Kulongoski. I'm the state representative from District 43, and I'll put my conflict of interest disclaimer in that I am an attorney down in Eugene, and we have a rule in the House Judiciary Committee, upon which I am a member with Representative Stoltz and Representative Frohnmeyer, that we generally do not appear in the other chamber either opposing or supporting a bill, and that is not my intention. My intention is to first of all state that I recognize there is a problem. And I think it's a very serious problem. It's a very immediate problem. But I think the committee has to first look at the parties in interest. Who are we talking about? Who are the ones that we're trying to direct this bill toward? And I would propose to you that the first is that we're talking about the general public, because the general public is entitled to reasonable medical services. Secondly, we're talking about the doctors, because that is closely related to them providing these medical services to the general public, because I believe that they have a right, and as we all do, to engage in a practice that where they're going to be secure in knowing that they're not, every time that they perform their professional service, that they're not going to be subject to a lawsuit that could wipe them out of their business. The third, and I think that many times that it's the most overlooked person in this process right now, and it's the claimant, the plaintiff. Because we all agree that the plaintiff or the claimant or the patient is entitled to be compensated for the negligent act of a doctor or any person. And the fourth, and it's the one that I've had most concern with in this whole bill, and it's the insurance industry. And I ask you to look at ask yourselves of who we're attempting to develop a bill for. Is it the doctors? I personally, and I've told the doctors, that I have a great deal of difficulty of sympathizing with them personally with the income level and their payment of the professional liability insurance. I don't think the bill is any windfall for the legal profession, nor is it a windfall, and this is what concerns me, for the patient. But I am concerned about the idea that we're bargaining with the insurance industry to find out if they're going to continue in this state to write medical malpractice coverage. If they don't, and they have made the representations that by next July there's a chance that they will not be here, I think that the bill was written with the idea of, one, of trying to get them to stay here in the state and write professional liability insurance, and two, to ensure that when they do, that there is some level in which all the four parties that I've identified can have some level of benefit from this particular bill. I personally, and as Representative Stoltz said, that I went to a dinner with down in Eugene about 2 weeks ago. It was about the Saturday before the bill came to the floor, and Professor Hans Lindy down at the University of Oregon was talking to me, and he said, you know, Ted, he says, I'm not going to ask you why you did this or why the committee is. He said, I just want you to tell me the facts upon which you based the decisions that you did in formulating this bill. And he says, I'll start off with the $400,000 level. And I guess, as Representative Stoltz says, somebody said 100,000 and somebody else said 1 million, and we're getting close with 400. Why generals and specials together? Again, that was a compromise. And I think that if you look at the tapes of the House Judiciary Committee, you'll find out there was a great deal of debate on this bill. I think that I personally do not have any problem with the idea of a limitation in this area. Now, I know that there are people that are going to tell you that there's a legal problem, a constitutional problem, and I recognize their argument. I guess that it's one of those issues that you're looking at wrongful death suits, and we've had a limitation for some time before the legislature took it off in 71 when they upped it from 25,000. But what I wanted to point out were some of the problems that I foresaw, and I must tell you that they're in the area of attorney fees, because I think that the bill, and I know Representative Stoltz stated that it was implicit in the in the bill that the contingent fee would be done away with and you'd be on a reasonable attorney fee basis. The three situations that I foresee is, if you read the bill very closely, it talks about the filing of a lawsuit. Now, I think that there's a problem about what sort of a fee agreement are you talking about prior to the filing of a lawsuit, but settlement. Now, are you talking about having a motion filed by the attorney and then going to court for the reasonable attorney fee to have the court set it? The second situation is after filing but prior to verdict, and the court, and you get a settlement in the case at that time. How is the attorney fee provision to be resolved at that point? And the third, which I think that the bill does speak to, and that's when the verdict comes in, and you're talking about a verdict award, and the attorney fees are awarded by the court on top of that. I think that there's, and it's the same argument that I made in the House Judiciary Committee. I have a concern about the public policy, one, of having an attorney fee in a personal injury case, the attorney fees greater than the verdict or the monetary award for the victim. And I do that because I'm concerned about the public image, very candidly, of what that appearance gives. If the plaintiff would get $10,000 and the attorney fee is $50,000, that bothers me personally. And the second part is the question that I think you're going to have to look at it, of whether what type of limit we actually have with the $400,000 and then the reasonable attorney fees on top of it. If the purpose of the limitation is to have it so that the insurance company's actuaries can determine a level of reserve of funds that they must keep, I think there's a problem with that, of whether the attorney fees on top of that can ever give them that figure that they're going to be faced with, that they can judge what their reserve accounts would be. My concern about the reasonable attorney fees, other than the case that goes to verdict, is the fact that I dislike putting the court in the position of me walking in with an itemized statement of hours and time, and the court telling me, which I think that all of us that have practiced know that the court, there will be some judges that will do this, that are going to say, you know, Mr. Kulongoski, I know that you put in the time you did, and I do know that the expenses you have incurred are such, but I don't believe that public policy should be that I should give you more money than the plaintiff. And that bothers me because, see, the court's looking at my billing and he's saying that I did it and then I really didn't do it. Now, and then there are going to be judges, like I said, that I think that will come in on a $10,000 verdict, and you will get judges that will say, listen, the man put in 200-300 hours in this case and everything, and he's entitled to the reasonable attorney fees based on an hourly billing rate. And I happen to believe that that's true, because if you're going to go that way, I think the court should base it upon the time that you spent. So I've raised a number of problems that I foresee in the attorney fee area, and I raise those because I know Representative Myers isn't here tonight, but he and I talked about it, and I know Dr. Ferguson, we were all sitting together, and I want to tell you that Dr. Ferguson is one of the most astute doctors. I know that he hasn't been sued, but he sure knows a lot about what the attorneys and the doctors' relationships are. And, you know, that I have a great concern that we reach a problem, because I know down in Eugene, the tensions between the bar and the medical profession have been strained over this issue. And I think that it's gone completely out of context, because I think the doctors feel that the attorneys are looking after their interest, and the attorneys think they're looking after the doc. You know, the doctors are just looking at their own self-interest. I don't believe that's true. I believe there's a real problem, and I want it solved. But I'd like to do it with a piece of legislation that will be most amenable to all the parties concerned. I'll tell you right now, I dislike being put in the position to bargain with the insurance industry. I believe we're doing that. I can't tell you any reasonable alternative to it. I believe the bill before you is a vehicle to solve that problem. And I think it's on your committee. I hope that you have some of the lively debates that we had in the House and the Judiciary Committee over this issue. And as Representative Stoltz said, I think that you'd find that we were hopelessly split on a number of issues, and what you have is the compromises that we reached. I think that other than the attorney fee, as far as the form consent and the res ipsa statute of limitation, I think that those are spoken to. I think the questions you have is the idea of the limitation, and the second is to clear up the attorney fees, because I do believe it is unclear. And I think it should be clear, because I think it's going to cause some problems if we don't. That's all I have.
Questions? Ted, do you have any ideas about how to reach attorney's fees at stages before trial?
Well, you know, when Representative Frohmeyer and I got into the argument, Senator, that in the House Judiciary Committee, that the question becomes that if an attorney enters into a contention fee agreement prior to trial under that bill, and it's in a contract, can anyone set aside the contract? Now, I guess that the court could if they find it unconscionable. I don't think the bill says that contingent fee contracts are unconscionable. My feeling all along has been that prior to the settlement, I personally, and I'm going to state right now, as far as I'm concerned, the bar could eliminate the contingent fee. I happen to believe it's one of those stigmas on our profession that unless it's taken away, that I think it's always going to be hanging over us, and I think that it's got to be eliminated for a public policy reason. I do not believe that it's the great evil that a lot of the public believes, and I think what the medical profession believes. But I would believe, Senator, that if the attorney and his client entered into a contractual relationship prior to the settlement, I personally think that that's the way it should be resolved. It's obvious that if you don't go on the contingent fee before trial, I think that the way the bill is written, that you're talking about a motion to have the court set the reasonable attorney fee. Now, I know that it isn't read in directly into that, but I think that it can, as Representative Stoltz, it is implied that that was his intent, our intent, I should say. So I would think that if they had an agreement prior to settlement, that that should be honored. I really do.
But then go before the court to enforce the agreement?
That is the only way. If in fact that the attorney and his client some way get into a dispute as to how the matter should be handled.
Let me ask you another question on the... do you think that in the instructions to the jury, the court would be required to instruct the jury that under no case can they fine for more than $400,000?
That was supposed to be in the bill, I thought. Yeah. That was one of the oversights, because if I remember, is Bob still here, Stoltz? I do believe, Senator, that, you know, when the bill was printed and the doctors were wanting to get something moving, and... That issue was discussed in committee, and it was decided that that would be an instruction to the jury, that there should be a statement in the bill that there should be an instruction to the jury.
All right, that they could not fine for more than $400,000. Do you think that would influence the jury to fine for $400,000?
I do, very definitely. That's my own personal opinion. I do.
And it's a psychological thing. The jury's going to say we can't go over it, so we're going to go to the max.
That's correct.
Other questions? Senator Powell.
Did your committee receive testimony on the amount of the dollar that is settled on reaches the plaintiff?
Yeah. I'm going to defer that to the insurance industry because they have some very elaborate figures that they can tell you about, and they're going to go into that, and they have all of those. And all I would tell you is just note that most of it, far greater amount, goes to the defense attorneys than it does to the plaintiff's attorney. But they have that information for you. The other point in the bill, Senator, is the collateral source rule. And we talked about it, and I might tell you that that was one of the reasons we did decide on the $400,000 limitation, is that we kept the collateral source rule here in Oregon, which is basically that if the plaintiff has paid for a medical coverage plan or has some disability program, he gets to keep that in addition to the verdict.
What's that called?
Where is that in the bill?
The collateral source. It's not in the bill. That's why it's not spoken to, because that's presently the law in Oregon, and we didn't change that at all.
It's called?
The collateral source rule. It was discussed in committee. I shouldn't agree.
Could make a lawyer out of you, Senator.
Well, we passed one letting the professors in. Maybe we can let me.
Well, the teachers in.
The only thing I want to leave the committee with is that there is a problem. There is a very serious problem, and I happen to believe that legislation has to come about.
Questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Representative Dr. Ferguson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Bill Ferguson. I'm the state representative from District 4. I guess if Representative Kulongoski explained his conflict, I must explain mine also. I'm a part-time practicing physician in Washington County, and with any luck at all, soon will be a full-time practicing physician again. My testimony will be very brief. You're going to have a lot of experts to hear who have lots of information and so forth. I would simply point out to you that Oregon legislatively has been known for being a state that acts way ahead of the rest of the United States. The bottle bill and things of this nature are well known. I can say that California had this opportunity about 8 years ago and chose to take no action whatsoever. Repeatedly they had the opportunity, as one insurance company after another collapsed in California, and each time another company would come in and try, because the market was so large, each company thought they could make a profit. You've been reading in the papers, I'm quite sure, about what's happening in San Francisco now. The anesthesiologists are on strike because they can find no malpractice insurance anywhere. I think we have an opportunity to act here with thoughtful consideration. We are not under a crisis situation as far as, we still have insurers. Whether we will have 2 years from now, no one knows. People predict one thing and some predict another. With the passage of this bill, we will be able to have malpractice insurance because we'll be able to write it ourselves. There is a serious problem. You'll hear plenty of testimony to that effect. And I hear a great deal about preventative medicine, and I think I would have to include this in the category of preventative legislation. Do you have any questions that I might help?
You say preventative. For how long? Do you see this as being a permanent kind of arrangement, or?
No, I think this is long-term preventative. I don't think this is a short-term solution. There were several proposals which were short-term solutions. But I believe that this should see, this will do speak, as far as I can see, and again, I started studying this problem on January 14th when one of my colleagues asked, what about the horrible malpractice problem? I said, there isn't any malpractice problem, but I hadn't read the editorial in the Oregonian. Noting that my premiums were going up and whatnot. So at that point, I became quite interested in this. I went back to Washington, D.C., and to a conference with the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, and listened to what was a real problem I discovered at that time, a national problem, not just in Oregon. We just happened to have a little more time than many of the other states have. You're going to find things in this bill that probably various groups of people don't agree with. I can't say that I'm all that enthusiastic about it as far as my own position is concerned. I've never carried malpractice insurance beyond the 100-300 level. by virtue of this bill, I'll carry it at the $400,000 level now. Because for this to be the limit, I must carry $400,000 worth of insurance. So, personally, I have things I object to. You're going to find other people who have things they object to, so forth. But I think I would like to take this opportunity to commend the Judiciary Committee. I've never seen anyone work so hard as far as getting to the basis of a problem and seeing if they can come up with a long-term solution for it. I think the long-term solution lies in self-insurance. It probably lies there for most professions, if not all, and perhaps even under one joint policy. This is what the interim committee policy or committee is set up to do, to see whether or not this can all be done together. I think the only reason the doctors happen to be the first ones here to do this is we had a more immediate problem. The attorney's malpractice insurance went up 300% this year. What it goes up next year, I don't have any idea. But we're just a little bit ahead. And our 179%, you can't very well compare percentages unless you know percentages of what. The 179% when it raises the malpractice premium for the Category 5 doctor to $12,000 is a sizable increase, even though the attorneys had a 300% increase. So I think I spent a lot of hours listening to testimony along with the Judiciary Committee, just out of interest as much as anything else. I suppose a vested interest is a good way to put that. But I think the bill they have put together is a good one, and it is a long-term solution. Nothing's going to affect the premiums this year. Nothing. There isn't anything in the world that I can think of that could be done that will affect this year's malpractice premium. So any questions I might answer for, I'd be happy to.
Yeah, we've heard what this bill is supposed to do for the insurance companies and for the doctors. Now, what you're going to do for the people?
Well, most insurance is carried in my practice. My only source of income is from my patients. Therefore, all my business expenses are paid by fees. Malpractice insurance is a business expense, and it's passed through to the patient. It's going to reduce their costs. Having talked to some anesthesiologists who pay the very, very high premium, if they assure me that if this bill drops their premiums back down, that they'll be able to reduce their fees. So that's one thing it'll do for the people. As far as any other specific thing, I don't know, other than the fact that if you're a people living in San Francisco, I can tell you what not having it will do to you.
Well, I think maybe I didn't make myself clear, but some things I've read recently indicate that the problem is not necessarily an insurance problem. It's a problem that, for one reason or another, the level of care that should be used in caring for people, it really isn't at that high level. And that the problem maybe is that that there are lots of people getting hurt, even a few of them dying, as a result of the carelessness of people in the medical trade. Now, what is this bill going to do about that? What's this going to do about the incompetent doctor? There must be some, you know. There has to be any group of people. There's got to be some incompetent. And yet, practically none of them, I understand, have lost their ticket here. Now, what's this going to do to help weed out those incompetents that are still licensed and practicing?
The first half of the bill speaks almost exclusively to that particular problem. I ceased to mention that not because of deference to the incompetent physician, but I was sitting in the meeting I told you about in Washington, D.C., when the insurance people said that you could take all of the incompetent doctors in the United States and drown them tomorrow, and it wouldn't affect the cost of malpractice insurance a bit.
Just because they said that, do you necessarily believe that?
Yeah, because it's not necessarily the incompetent doctor who gets sued. Sometimes the most competent, the one who's willing to risk something to see if he can learn more or do more, is the one who is sued most often. So the correlation, not the incompetent doctor is much more apt, I think, to butter his patient along so that they don't realize that anything has been done wrong. But the bill does speak to at least some things that we have all in the medical profession objected to for a long time. The State Board of Medical Examiners has usually wanted an absolute concrete case against a physician before they would want to move on it, because he had legal recourse to prevent them from doing something as far as taking his license is concerned. This bill speaks to this very, very well, in that I can now, anytime I suspect one of my colleagues of being incompetent or he suspects me, we can report this with immunity. The board is obligated by the way the statute is written to pursue this, to find out exactly what's going on. They can require mental, physical, and practice competency examinations if necessary to determine this. And I think even though I did choose to believe them in Washington, D.C., if they're not right, this bill does speak to that problem now as far as protecting people are concerned.
Other questions? Senator Burbidge.
What you just described sounds as though the problem is not malpractice, but the problem, if there really is one, and apparently there is the daring, innovative, maybe even to the point of being cavalier, surgeon or doctor who's willing to take a risk beyond even what the bill would point out. This is what appears to me that you just described as the problem of medical malpractice and not incompetence.
I'm sorry, that isn't what I was trying to say. I'm trying to say that making progress in medicine, you don't make any progress in medicine unless you find some small number of doctors who have courage enough to try something no one else has tried. Now, we like to think they're all in medical schools, and, you know, I mean, this is what a medical school is for, so that the residency's there, they can learn to do. Someone had to do the first total hip replacement so that people with arthritic hips could walk. The man who has courage enough to do that might well be the man who, by the same token, would be the one most apt to be sued. Because when he did the third one or the fourth one, and finally he's going to do one in which things are not going to go right, the public now expects that a doctor shall never do anything except something that will make you perfectly well.
Well, I want to ask one more.
Go ahead.
Or two. One of them. You've got the pass it still the way it is tonight. You've got a limitation there. And then hopefully you've got insurance that most they can't walk away from, or there's going to be some additional layer of insurance eventually somewhere along the line. So then you put this innovative doctor in a position of being even more bold. Now, I don't suggest that you, that kind of a surgeon and physician very efficacious thing for the general health of society, but don't you then begin to compound the problem if that's part of the problem?
No, I don't think so. The people who are like that are exactly like the Edisons and the rest of the people in the world who have a unique capability for being willing to try something and have it go well. I'm not saying that we're all running around experimenting on people. We're not. It takes only a peculiar type of person who will do the first heart transplant or the first total hip replacement and so forth. And they're extremely confident. They're much better than anyone else in their field, or they wouldn't have courage enough to go ahead and do this.
What level of liability coverage must a anesthesiologist or a very active bone surgeon
Five million, most of them carry.
What would be the difference in premium rates between 400,000 and 5 million?
I'm sure somebody will be happy to tell you that. I can't tell you the figures.
That,
pardon?
Didn't they tell you people that over there?
He's not on the committee that held pretty good. Other questions? Senator Howard.
I think that one illustration. I had the first scapies operation on my ear when they went in here in Oregon. And they openly told me that it was brand new. I might lose total hearing in my ear. As far as I'm concerned, that was on my part, that was a real risk. The doctor told me what it was. It was a success. And now I can hear a lot better than I could before. So I'm a person glad that some physician in Oregon with Dr. Petrov, while he's not here, nobody should have all the credit for it. I'm glad he had nerve enough to try. And something's gone wrong. I knew what my responsibilities were. But I might be totally new.
Right, but the point I was trying to make was that the first nine of these may have gone well, and the tenth man may have gone totally deaf.
The second one I did.
And the tenth man's much more apt to sue a physician who's doing this than if he hadn't done it, is all I'm trying to say. I'm not saying that it's the additional risk that he puts himself in.
Other questions? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you very much.
Representative Frommeyer, you changed your mind?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm making a lot of other witnesses very unhappy, Senator Roberts. So
I expect we're going to have more than one hearing on this.
All right.
So.
I think I can be very brief, but I do want to touch some points I think that are significant in terms of the deliberations we've had before. For the record, I'm Dave Frommeyer, State Representative in District 40, a member of the House Judiciary Committee, which has considered this bill. In terms of my own personal history, my first acquaintance with medical malpractice problem goes back some 5 or 6 years when I worked as an assistant to Secretaries Finch and then Richardson at HEW, when very much we began to be concerned about the alarming increase in incidence of medical malpractice litigation and its cost for the healthcare industry. That interest has continued in my other capacity as a teacher of tort law, and in the months since this legislature has begun, I've made efforts to talk to virtually every national authority I could find by telephone or by letter to discuss the issue of medical malpractice. I've read the 800-page report of the Secretary's Commission on Medical Malpractice, which I commend to this committee. I don't think it's realistic to expect you can read 800 pages in the remaining weeks of the session, but I do want to indicate at least that that's part of the background that our committee did consider in this issue. That's the first and really only comprehensive study of the medical malpractice issue that has been done in the nation. I think we do have a crisis. I think the only question is whether the crisis will come on us and require a special session next April, or whether we will have the foresight to deal with it now. But I am convinced that we have to do something this session that is substantial, that addresses what we perceive to be the short and long-term problems of medical malpractice. I don't think there's any question about it. I heard Senator Cook ask one of your witnesses, what does this bill do to the consumer or for the consumer? And I think I can answer that question in perhaps 6 or 7 different ways, because they are issues that we concern. Number one, I think it will deal with the question of higher insurance rates. I think we're already stuck with those rates that are with us for the present time because they're based upon existing law. But without some kind of legislative action, I think we can see escalation of insurance rates continually. Those rates are either taken out as tax deductions and therefore indirectly subsidized by the people as a whole, or they're passed on in the form of higher prices, or both. So they directly affect the cost of medical care that's paid by the healthcare consumer, whether we like doctors doing that or not. That is a fact. It's going to happen. That's a healthcare consumer issue. Second point deals with the insurability of the medical profession at all. We know about the doctor strike in San Francisco. That's received widespread publicity. I think it's not so generally well known that if you're a patient for elective surgery in the state of Alaska, the past few months you've had to be flown to Seattle at your own expense at a horrendous attendant cost to have any kind of elective surgery due to the unavailability of malpractice insurance for anesthesiologists. And I say that's a consumer issue. That directly affects the accessibility of health care to all kinds of members of our population. I think that to the extent that the bill ensures greater peer control, as it really does in the first 5 sections of the bill, if you'll read it, enormously increases the power of the Board of Medical Examiners to a degree that could not have occurred, I think, legislatively a decade ago. We'll have closer peer control over the quality of care that a consumer gets. I think to the extent that you consider the issue of defensive medicine, you will see that the malpractice issue bears a direct relationship to that. Let me expand on that a little bit, although I know you have doctors and representatives from the OMA who will be here to talk about that. But when we talk about defensive medicine, that's a subject of a lot of dispute. You know, do doctors over-prescribe? Do they take more x-rays and diagnostic tests than they really need to in order to protect themselves against what they consider to be groundless claims? Well, I can tell you that virtually all of the doctors that were surveyed by the Secretary's Commission on Medical Malpractice felt that they did. Not only do some of those diagnostic tests themselves contain greater risks to health care, for example, excessive use of x-rays, but it's obvious, I think, to anyone who looks at them that the types of tests that one must undergo to be sure that every conceivable possibility has been exhausted sometimes are good medicine, but always are more expensive. That's a consumer issue. I think that's directly related to the kind of climate in the malpractice issue that we have to deal with as a consumer issue. I would not have supported this bill if I had not felt that the health consumer gets a fair shake out of it. I think it's also fair to say that it is an interim solution. I think you'll hear from a lot of witnesses who will say, over the long run, we have to look at a different kind of solution to the problem. And I'm very much taken with John Maynard Keynes's response to that kind of statement. In the long run, we're all dead. We have to deal with the potential insurability or lack of insurability of the Oregon medical profession within the next 18 months until a more careful, long-range study of the Oregon professional liability climate can be completed during the interim. I don't think there is any alternative to that. Let me address two other issues. One is the issue of the damage limitation, $400,000. Senator Burbidge just asked whether or not there was a difference between insurability for $400,000 or $5 million. Our study showed that the difference is substantial, Senator. There are two areas where the premiums really climb, that between zero and $100,000 and between $1 million and $5 million. And my guess, without having the figures at my fingertips, although they could be supplied to you, is that it's something at least a third and perhaps greater than that, the increase in the premium. So that the level of the damage limitation does make a substantial amount of difference. And it's not only the level, it's also the... Yes, sir.
It's relatively easy then to get a level of coverage up to this less than $500,000.
I think it's questionable whether any coverage will be available in the existing climate. And if I were not persuaded of that point, I wouldn't be as adamant as I am about the necessity for a damage limitation. I think we're not merely talking about the rate of increase of premiums. I think we're talking about the insurability of the medical profession as a professional liability issue entirely. And I think that that's what struck your committee on the judiciary. So we may be talking about a profession that's totally uninsurable in less time than it takes to convene the next regular legislative session. That's the issue with which we have to deal.
Well, before we leave that, I think it's really important to bear in mind that if a bunch of real estate developers, land developers, can bring this legislature stomping into a special session, something like this probably could.
I agree with you, and I have to tell you, as a legislator who would be subject to that, that I would far rather deal with it with the limited foresight that we can bring to bear in our regular session than be stampeded into a quite irrational and perhaps unnecessarily adverse response from the standpoint of the healthcare consumer. That remains my position. I think one other thing about the bill is a good thing, and that is that the bill specifies that the doctors can form a company for mutual self-insurance. I think there's all kinds of evidence that Oregon physicians are the victims of nationwide trends that are not necessarily exemplified in the state of Oregon. I think that actuarially, insurance companies calculate premiums on the basis of their claims experience in states like California and New Jersey, where jury verdicts in California have been 18 verdicts in excess of $1 million in the last 12 months. That's going to have an impact, the national claims climate. Whether or not Oregon doctors are more careful, whether or not Oregon juries are more conservative in their awards. And what could be done by setting up a self-insurance company, and what I hope that the Oregon doctors do is set up their own so that not only can they police themselves by virtue of the Board of Medical Examiners, but also so that their claims experience is related to the actual premiums that are paid here and to the actual jury verdicts that are paid here. Now, Madam Chairman, with all due respect, I think that there are only a limited number of options. that anyone faces dealing with this issue. I don't like bargaining with insurance companies. I do think that much has been, much that the literature reveals would tend to indicate that premium rates are as much a function of stock market losses of the principal insurance companies as they are of actual increase in claims. But be that as it may, if you canvass the alternatives, and I'll do that as a sort of a thumbnail sketch in the next 90 seconds, I don't think any of them is very attractive in terms of a solution that can realistically be arrived at in the next 2 weeks. One of them is a no-fault system. And there are some intriguing, literature about a no-fault system in the beginning to appear in the law reviews. But Commissioner Rawls can testify on that more accurately than I think that it's demonstrated that initially the cost of a no-fault system would be even greater than the cost that we're now paying. The second alternative, and one that I personally favor, is arbitration. But arbitration is very difficult unless you abolish the constitutional right to a jury trial that's currently part of the Oregon political system. And I think for all kinds of other reasons, that's an unwise alternative. One can tinker with arbitration systems. We did in our bill preserve the private rights to arbitration of group care policies, but I think that realistically over a 2 week period, that's not something that's attainable. A third alternative is workman's compensation. That would much more radically restrict the rights of recovery in terms of scaled benefits for the victim, and it would also be something that would be incredibly elaborate to try to set up by in a way of legislative language with no prior experience with claims. We can tinker with the present system, play with some doctrines that most of the testimony have shown have relatively little impact on the claims experience. You can limit damages, or you can have damages awarded in a periodic basis rather than in a lump sum. Or you could ask the Congress to pass a system of national health insurance, which might do more than anything to ameliorate the claims climate. But of those alternatives, I think your committee considered all of them, considered the literature on them in great care, and the bill that we came up with, although admittedly a compromise, I think is a responsible compromise. And I urge your committee to consider it in light of what we all felt, at least in the other House, was a crisis of serious proportions that's coming on us. Thank you.
Questions, Representative Frohman.
You're as good a person as any to ask this question, so I guess your committee in this deliberation on the maximum claim, did you consider at any time the possibility of an allotment beyond the 400,000 amount based on practical or average work life of an individual? For example, if I went to medical school, just graduated, was on my way home late one night in an automobile accident, taken to the emergency room, and a doctor muffed things, I had brain damage, I'm 25, I have a bright future, $400,000, and I'm, you know, incapable. Was any consideration given to the...
Yes, I think a lot. And I think that I'd be less than candid if I didn't say that in some cases it may well be that you could prove a future earning expectancy of in excess of $400,000. But we bore in mind two things. Number one, that the largest jury verdict that's ever been awarded in Oregon, as far as we could determine from our testimony, was $500,000. And I'll make the assumption, although I don't know it to be a fact, that that included in the jury's mind at least a contingent fee award. So my view as to what the plaintiff probably got in that case was a maximum of $350,000. So the actual award is higher than that, and the attorney's fees come on the top of it. The purpose for setting a damage limitation, and you must keep it in mind if you consider this to be a serious issue, is the insurability of the profession, which depends upon actuarially sound and certifiable and ascertainable limitations to the total amount of liability exposure. And there is no other way to do it than to have some certain which constitutes the upper limit. And that's the dilemma in which you're placed, because you can always think of the case of the neurosurgeon who's run over and permanently damaged, whose actuarial life expectancy and earnings capacity could be multi-million dollar. But the question is, if you allow for that, what kind of other adverse economic consequences do you cause to a system in which everyone must remain insured? And it's not an easy dilemma to resolve, although it was long ago resolved in workman's compensation cases at a much, much lower level of compensation.
I've talked to several people about my concern, and I read one of the senators' column about Just one case in a great multitude of cases of this, the judge might feel, along with the jury, that the $400,000 limitation was not enough. Is there any way that they can bypass the lower court and the judge can say, no, in this case, the field court will set the overall damage? That would be the insurance carrier. We do this in automobile insurance. Once in a great while, you've got somebody loaded with cool news that does a lot of damage and have a bad driver, and so the loss goes sky high. But only in this case, one in 20,000. The underwriters could protect themselves. They would know that they weren't putting their fate in a jury, but they were putting it in five judicial hands. And in that case, they could say, well, this is an exception, and I don't know what the field court does, but I don't know it for that. Someplace along the line, some higher jurisdiction would say, hey, this one deserves more. Is there an area that this could be done?
Well, Senator, I'd say, it's intriguing to think of the cases where you might try to do greater equity by trying that, and I'm not an insurance expert, so I don't want to speak to it definitively, but I think it would be extremely difficult, first of all, to write the law in such a way that that particularly equitable case could be recognized, and secondly, to have a profession that's insurable if you do that. And I'm not talking about giving windfall profits to out-of-state insurance companies. I'm even talking about whether or not an actuary would ever be able to put together an Oregon company based on Oregon experience and get reinsurance, which is the key on which most of these companies have failed so far, from the national companies or from Lloyd's of London. Well, you know, St. Paul Fire and Marine is not all that anxious to stay in the malpractice insurance business in Oregon now.
In all fairness, someplace along the line, some guy that is really locked up for life, maybe the 400,000 isn't too.
I can make that case time after time with respect to victims who are covered by workman's compensation. One can make that with respect to the limit of $50,000 on wrongful death, that there's a person who's killed whose family is left destitute, who should be getting higher. And ultimately, we run across the problem of spreading and allocating losses in our society, and sooner or later, we have to say that for the vast range of people, in order to get a system that's sound financially, that will stay in business, we have to draw lines that preserve that. And I think that's what we're doing here.
I'm on for the question.
Yes.
Didn't suggest then that your committee arrived at the $400,000 figure other than just strictly something that would attract insurance companies to sell insurance. That's the only real.
Well, I wouldn't say that. No, I wouldn't say that. Because I think that my own vote and judgment was premised on the dark assumption that there won't be any insurance offered by national companies to Oregon physicians within 2 years. That's a possibility. It's a strong possibility. And therefore, what we have to look at is some kind of system whereby we can get some form of alternative insurance. And there are only two options there, Senator, with all due respect. One is either a joint underwriting association, which is the subject of Commissioner Rawls' bill, or doctor's mutual insurance.
Other than the consumer, how it relates to the passing off to the consumer the cost of the insurance, but I've never heard you refer back to the consumer's interest with respect to the $400,000 list. And did anybody ever crank into the equation how long it would take eat up the $400,000 in, I haven't even finished my question,
sir.
You anticipate. But on the hypothetical case, Senator Powell posed of the 25-year-old person because of the negligence of a medical practitioner is rendered a living vegetable for until he's 65 or life expectancy. How long is it going to take to eat up that $400,000 taking care of that person at age 25?
Yes, we did consider it, Senator, and at great length. And several considerations came into view, and I'll reiterate them. Number one, probably in terms of the take-home award for the victim, in the state of Oregon, $400,000 cash is more that a victim has taken home in any case that's been litigated in the state of Oregon now. So I think that to the extent that we've looked at jury verdicts, we're actually setting as a limit more than's ever been awarded. And the other one, and I can play the same record again and again, and it'll stay broken and keep cracking at the same place, is the question of some kind of climate that will continue the insurability of the Oregon medical profession, because if it's not, we're going to see far more adverse consequences to the healthcare consumer than any of those that can be imagined in the hypothetical case, which, if you accept it as your model, will destroy the insurability of the profession. It's an unpleasant dilemma. It's one that I don't like living with any more, I'm sure, than you do. But I think it's a real one that we have to face up to. Whether
thank
or not
you,
will you...
Fromar, we're going to try to get on to some of the doctors and lawyers and insurance people who are here, and we appreciate
thank
it
you.
Very much. Bob Drenetti and Tom, who are you bringing with you, Bob?
Sure.
Thank you.
I bet I'll hear everything one time.
I correct my reading.
Members of the committee, I am Bob Drenetti, and I represent the 2,900-member Oregon Medical Association, which supports passage of House Bill 2647. Mr. Tom Cooney, to my right, is legal counsel for the OMA, and I, along with Mr. Cooney, will present the medical profession's point of view with respect to the bill, and will propose technical amendments and amendments to substantive law, which you have before you. First, the problem. We've heard a lot about solutions and some about the problem, but permit me, if you will, to go through some of the areas that are truly the problem. The cost of medical liability insurance in Oregon has evolved from an almost incidental cost to one of the largest expenses in the practice of medicine. In 1975, the typical physician in Oregon, the typical family physician, must be prepared to pay nearly $6,000 in premium for professional liability insurance.
Could I ask about that typical? I just wonder that what you just said is at odds with what I understand to be the exact. I've been told that more than half of the
physicians in Oregon are in class one for insurance purposes.
That is not true, Senator.
All right, what, do you have the exact numbers of class one through six?
Senator Roberts, if I may proceed, I can make reference to the material that we have provided as supportive data to...
I think Senator Cook, he's got quite a lot of information here.
I was looking through his exhibits, and he only provides us with class six and class four. I don't see the rest of it.
Class four being the...
Well, let's let him proceed, and if he doesn't answer your question, then you can put it to him.
Surgical specialties are faced with premiums of up to $12,300. These rates are 2 to 3 times as much as premiums for the same coverage 1 year ago and 30 to 40 times that of premium 10 years ago. The tables 1, 2, and 3 in the material provided illustrate these increases. Liability insurance premiums are part of the cost of doing business in the medical community, and it must ultimately be borne by the individual patient of a physician in the form of higher medical expenses, and of course thus cause substantial increases in the cost of medical services above and beyond the regular inflationary impact that everyone has experienced. But cost, as you have heard, is not the only problem. The availability of medical professional liability insurance at any price looms as a very real threat in Oregon as it does in other states today. The underwriter of professional liability insurance for the University of Oregon system, including the medical school, has announced that it will not renew coverage effective October 1 of this year. One of the principal underwriters in this state has already refused to renew policies for anesthesiologists and has selectively refused to insure other high-risk specialists. And the major group professional medical liability insurance underwriter, CNA, in this state, has said it cannot and will not indicate whether or not it will renew physicians in Oregon at the conclusion of its contract with the OMA on April 30, 1976, less than a year away. While Oregon may be considered more fortunate than other states who have received cancellation notices from insurance companies, the potential for a very serious crisis in this state is very real. Reasons for the malpractice phenomena are very complex. Assumption might be that doctors aren't doing as good a job as they used to, but fortunately we know that this is not the case. Expanded medical procedures, however, have created risks, which you've heard about, which not only a few years ago were non-existent. With these risks, most acutely ill patients have been given a new lease on life, where heretofore they were added to mortality statistics. To some extent, the technological sophistication of the medical profession is partly responsible. The public is constantly exposed in the media and on such TV programs as Marcus Welby to the availability of so-called miracle drugs and miracle therapy. Thus, to some extent, the present problem lies with expectations of cure not always possible. Moreover, today's patient is better informed, has higher expectations, and is more likely to be critical when desired results are not fully obtained. A number of other factors contribute to the current situation. The willingness of juries to award ever larger judgments to patients they believe to have been injured in the course of medical care, the expansion and varying interpretation of certain legal precedents and doctrines which have special application to professional liability, and perhaps most importantly, the increasingly sense of society to seek legal redress and compensation for variances to what society believes is the norm. The medical profession recognizes that physicians have contributed in part to our present predicament. The advent of specialization has adversely affected the sacred physician-patient relationship. And finally, doctors sometimes do make mistakes. Fortunately, most do not result in injury or are quickly and uneventfully corrected. It is clear that the recently announced increases in premiums is already having a deleterious effect on the availability of medical services and on the cost of medical care in Oregon. Many older physicians in both rural and urban centers who practice 2 to 3 days per week have decided to retire from practice altogether. Several high-risk specialists have discontinued providing some services for which they are uniquely trained. And many young doctors are considering military or salaried institutional assignments rather than taking on or continuing private community-type practice. The community of Blue River in East Lane County, for example, has for some time attempted to seek medical services of a physician. Recently, a California doctor who desired to reduce his practice told the citizens of Blue River that he would move to the community in April of this year and practice part-time. However, on February 27th, the doctor wrote, quote, "The malpractice insurance rates have so greatly increased that such an action would be entirely unprofitable or even economically suicidal. I'm still moving to the area in April as planned, but I am forced to hold off opening any office until some change in malpractice rates is accomplished," close quote. In Pilot Rock, the sole general practitioner that Western Umatilla County community has advised that he can no longer continue to care for obstetrical patients, most of whom are welfare recipients, because the income from his obstetrical practice is considerably less than the amount of premium he will have to pay for obstetrical coverage. These two cases are among approximately 200 notifications that we have received since the first of the year where physicians have decided to take early retirement, reduce their practice, or not practice at all. And there will be more, as the new premiums are in fact received by physicians in the course of the next few months. Thus, the potential for more serious curtailment of medical service is very real, and as exemplified by what is occurring in California. The OMA estimates that the cost of the professional liability insurance in Oregon during 1975 will generate, if not exceed, an annual rate of nearly $20 million in premiums for physicians and hospital coverage combined. Our preliminary estimates of the application of malpractice rates to the basic cost of medical care, and I refer to specific physician medical services in his office, indicate that between 3 and 17% of the physician's fees represent the cost of professional liability insurance, that is, depending on the specialty of practice. In short, the average charge for services of a physician will approach 10% to cover the cost of professional liability insurance. It has been suggested that the dramatic increases in insurance premium is essential to bail out the huge investment losses of our insurance carriers. While the OMA does not wish to be placed in the position of defending the insurance industry's investment policies, we submit in evidence financial and claim summaries of our experience since 1969 under Hawaiian Insurance and since 1971 under CNA for the committee's review, and those are tables 4 and 5. Based on the disturbing situation that now exists and the potential crises that could well confront this state, the OMA developed the original House Bill 2647, which was co-sponsored by 38 senators and representatives. The following objectives were considered in development of this bill. The medical profession in Oregon must be insurable, and that any professional liability program can only continue if it is actuarially sound. Reasonable protection and fair compensation for injured parties must be assured. And factors of tort law which contribute to professional liability claims and awards should be modified to reasonable and realistic expectations. The penalizing effect which huge professional liability awards and settlements have on the economics of society must be reduced to the extent possible. And an early warning system must be developed to permit the medical profession, through its professional organizations and the State Board of Medical Examiners, to more quickly and effectively intervene when a physician begins to encounter difficulties. The OMA believes that patients who suffer injury as a result of medical negligence should be able to seek redress through the courts of this state. We have examined other proposed alternatives, such as arbitration, no fault, and compensatory type programs. They neither offer the type of relief that is absolutely essential in order to solve the current professional liability insurance problem, nor do they realistically offer the ingredients to prevent a far more serious crisis in the near future. Balloon awards amounting in the millions of dollars are occurring with greater frequency across the country. Such awards exceeding $1 million are now averaging one per month in California, and have contributed substantially to the insurance industry's unwillingness to continue to underwrite professional liability insurance. It's simply too volatile to price. Oregon has yet to experience a professional liability award in the millions of dollars, but plaintiffs are praying for million-plus awards, and we are fast approaching the amount. One jury award in the latter part of 74 resulted in a $500,000 verdict, and another during the same period of time amounted to $464,000. Out-of-court settlements, likewise, are increasing, not only in volume, but in size. Obviously, any departure from the present system is going to be considered controversial. But we in Oregon have never shied from controversy, particularly when circumstances demand that an alternative is absolutely essential to the health and welfare of the citizens of this state. Engrossed House Bill 2647, as passed by the House, offers an approach to the problem which has considerable merit, but it does fall short in some areas. There are also some technical errors in the bill for which we submit amendments entitled Page 1 Technical Amendments. The answer to assuring the availability of insurance lies in three areas, none of which alone will solve the problem. They include: a reasonable and realistic alternative ceiling must be placed on awards. Elements of substantive law which contribute to the filing of claims not based on true medical malpractice must be corrected. And the long period of time in which claims may be filed must be shortened. We all may propose initially that the best and most equitable alternative to the present system was basically a modification of the system, and that being a limitation on awards to true economic loss. Awards based on true law, economic loss, would guarantee to any injured party that the amount of the award would in fact be sufficient to cover all expenses for necessary corrective, medical, hospital, and rehabilitative services, as well as lost income or replacement services. Consideration of collateral sources would prohibit payment of duplicate coverages and awards, and the loss of income provisions would assure that an injured party would be compensated monthly and be guaranteed a source of income for a considerable length of time. It is essential to understand that long drawn out disability based on medical injury is the exception rather than the rule. By far, most cases which result in injury because of negligence are temporary and correctable. We therefore submit entitled Page 2 Award Limitation Amendments, which would substitute modified language of the true economic loss concept for Section 13 of the bill. Regarding elements of substantive law, I'd like to have Tom Cooney, who is the OMA legal counsel, outline the problems here and speak to the amendments proposed on pages 3 through 5. Cooney?
On page 10 of the engrossed bill, by the way, my name is Tom Cooney. I'm a lawyer. I represent the OMA and defend medical malpractice claims. On page 10,
are you talking about page 10 of the bill, Mr.
Cooney? Yes, section 10 deals with the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur. The original bill that was submitted requested that the House consider the feasibility of removing the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur from the field of medical malpractice. Instead, this version has been adopted, which in effect is probably the same as the common law to date. The matter of the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur in professional negligence cases came about in about 1965 in the Mayer versus Dowsett case. In tracing the developmental changes in our Supreme Court law starting in 63 when charitable immunity was abolished, res ipsa in 65 with Mayer versus Dowsett, extension of the statute of limitations under the discovery rule in 67, there's been a historical increase in the number of claims and a historical increase in cost, culminating in our present day problem. It was our recommendation that in the medical malpractice case, because of the unknown factors that exist in the treatment of the human body, that to impose the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur was unfair and unjust. Now, this was submitted and considered by the committee and rejected. However, through an amendment, we have asked this committee to reconsider it. There are two types of res ipsa loquitur. There is res ipsa loquitur as we know it as laymen, and the Supreme Court has said it is limited in medical malpractice cases to those areas of negligence which fall within the ken of laymen, as they call it. However, experience will show us in dealing with these cases that even sometimes the most obvious case has reasons unknown almost to medical science as to why something occurs. And it's almost akin to a lawyer trying a rear-end collision and losing for the plaintiff's side and being confronted with a thing speaks for itself, because normally you don't lose a rear-end type of accident and the lawyer would be faced with a potential claim. The other type of res ipsa loquitur is what we call professional testimony or expert testimony res ipsa, and that is where an expert witness testifies that this type of thing does not occur ordinarily unless there's a violation of the standards of practice. This too, we feel, is too vague in the unknown areas of dealing with medicine and the treating of the human body. So for those reasons, we could ask the committee reconsider the impact of abolishing the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur as it applies to medical malpractice. Now, one factor which I wish to point out, in Section 10, as the amendment now stands, Section 10, if you seek to retain res ipsa loquitur rather than abolishing it, Section 10 on page 10, which does retain it, on line 12, I think creates an ambiguity in the area of these two different types of res ipsa loquitur. Line 12, sub 3 says, in determining whether the injury is of a kind that ordinarily does not occur in the absence of someone's negligence, the jury may draw upon its own common knowledge or upon the testimony of experts. Now, in my judgment, that would allow, in a medical malpractice case, the jury to use common knowledge in any type case, whereas the Supreme Court has restricted it to those cases which are within the ken of laymen. And so I fear that this Section 3 is, instead a matter of codifying the existing law, is a perhaps unintentional possibility of extending the common law doctrine which limits common knowledge res ipsa to the knowledge of laymen. Because here, in this section, it says the jury may use either common knowledge or expert testimony. And I'm fearful that that could be interpreted to mean that the limitation that it be within the knowledge of laymen would not be as restricted as it is now in the present law.
Any questions? You limit it down to just fire and explosion. That would have to be oxygen, wouldn't it?
Well, there have been some gaseous type explosions from anesthetics and things of that sort.
Well,
yes.
But it takes a source of ignition.
Yes. Yes.
That wouldn't be the doctor's fault.
It could be. It
what
could
the devil
be.
Would he do to that one? That it would cause it. Had to be a short enough or a spark from somebody's heel or whatever.
Well, using one of those electrical cauterizers, when the gaseous fumes were not dissipated at a time when he shouldn't be using it, could possibly result in an explosion.
Any doctor ought to know whether the source of oxygen or any of those are these certain things that you shouldn't use anything that
right.
has a spark, but that should be, it could also be from pulling a plug from the wall that causes a spark. And
it could be the hospital. It could be the hospital's liability as opposed to the
doctor's liability.
It could be. Yeah.
I think most of that would be hospital liability. That sort of
proceed. Right. Well, this imposes liability on them if that occurs. Now, the second area of concern deals with Section 12. Section 12, as it appears in the engrossed bill which was passed out, deals with the doctrine of informed consent. The original bill, which we submitted, made some changes in the doctrine of informed consent, which were more designed to solve the problem of a physician being required, number one, to perhaps unduly frighten the patient with the matter of exposure to all the horrible risks that might occur, And secondly, taking away the uncertainty in the law as to what risks he is required to reveal to the patient, because the common law said that he must reveal all material risks. And I've found two factors from a practical standpoint for the physicians. Number one, many felt that it was, particularly in surgery, that it unduly enhanced the surgical risk and a natural human reluctance to perhaps frighten the patient before surgery. This is one factor that they were being faced with. They were reluctant to do it. The second factor is, what risks exactly did they have to tell them of, and what was a material risk? So the bill that we originally drew stated in effect that, number one, to obtain an informed consent, the physician must explain the procedure in general terms without further elaboration. Two, explain that there may be viable or feasible medical alternatives without an in-depth explanation of them, and that there may be risk in the procedure without enumerating the particular risks. And that, having done that, unless the patient requested further instruction, then the doctor was deemed to have the absolute informed consent of the patient. And this was done primarily, as I say, to allow the patient then to determine what risks and what fears he wished to have explained to him, and secondly, pin down a little bit more carefully just exactly what a material risk was. The proposed bill had that section, and it also had a proposed form that could be used in connection therewith. Section 12, as it is in the engrossed bill, is merely a recodification of the common law on informed consent as it now exists. The only thing is, I noticed in reading it tonight, is it deletes the requirement the physician explain the nature of the procedure. So it is something less than the common law, but really not, that is not an ideal omission. The matter of informed consent is a real practical everyday problem with the physician, because he doesn't know exactly what the law requires of him when it says a material risk, and that it's material if the consequences are serious, even though the likelihood of it occurring might be only a possibility. It's vague. So the bill that was submitted was done primarily to try and make it a little more clear. Moving to page 11, the limitation of awards. This has been a task that has been most difficult to try and evaluate. One form of the bill that was submitted dealt with the matter of limiting damages to economic loss, which obviously had some drawbacks because you eliminated the question of general damages and pain and suffering and impairment of future enjoyment. So that was had bad factors. This factor leaves general damages alone as we know them. However, it sets a maximum award, which, as everybody can see, may someday leave some individual without total and complete satisfaction. I think that we're fast approaching in our system perhaps a problem wherein the adequate award, as we refer to it, perhaps in some instances may be beyond private enterprise, private individual's ability to satisfy. And so for that reason, we may be coming into the era of some lid or some leveling down of the maximum award, realizing, as we must, that certain people will lose something, hopefully not much. The person that is totally incapacitated, of course, has the opportunity and in most instances is entitled to Social Security benefits. And if you have the $400,000 on top of that, and if it were invested, I'll take the figure of 10% because it's easy for me and my dumb brain to calculate, you'd have an income of $40,000 a year. not total, not complete, not fulfillment of everything, but when you consider certain things that we must give, perhaps this is the solution to it. Insofar as the section on attorney's fees, let me give you a little background of how this arose originally. In the original 2647, the measure of damages that was considered there was economic loss. And it was therefore felt, because of there was such a loss to the patient of his general damages, that it would be unfair to allow him to have to pay his attorney from his out-of-pocket expense. So in light of the type of limited damages that were being afforded, it was felt that if he prevailed, on top of that would be an award of reasonable attorney's fees. It was not intended in the original bill to eliminate the contingent fee or to interfere with the lawyer-client relationship, but to be something on top of the award, because his award was only out-of-pocket loss. What has occurred now is an award of attorney's fees in the area where we allow general damages. I personally do not quarrel with the contingent fee aspect in medical malpractice cases, because I do not feel that it is the reason why they're brought. Now, my colleagues and the people I work with disagree with me on this, but the way the bill is drawn now is possibly destroying something that we were trying to cut down: the frequency of claims, the extent of claims. And in this case, where we allow a reasonable attorney's fee on top of an award and abolish the contingent fee, we're going to encourage small claims of $1,000 or $2,000 or $3,000, which may, under the present system, not be filed because of the expense to the attorney in filing the case. So the way the present bill is written would permit, in my judgment, a defeating of something that we're trying to do, and that is cut down some of the cost, because this will award attorney's fees in a small case, which might be rather substantial, and which under your present system of the contingent fee may not exist at all. So this could create additional claims. Now, people will say, well, more claims are good, and I don't disagree that the people are harmed should be compensated. The question that we're equating is we've got to keep something to protect the professional people, be it private insurance or self-insurance. So I would ask that you consider on the attorney's fees one of two things: either leave the contingent fee alone and leave it as it is, or have the court set a reasonable attorney's fee within the award of the $400,000 as part of the $400,000. Now, that in effect eliminates or cuts down the contingent fee. But to give the attorney's fees now on top of this, the way it's written, is going to encourage some more expense in the defending of some of these claims. Now, moving to line 14 on page 11, which is the self-insurance bill.
You didn't propose amendments for the attorney's fees.
It's under technical amendments. It just merely says that the court shall, from the award.
Okay, the attorney fees then are part of the technical amendments. Huh?
Yes.
All right. Okay, go ahead.
The line 14 is the self-insurance program. This is...
What page is that?
On page 11, line 14, section 14. And this was previously Senate Bill 549, which I think was before another committee.
This is under technical amendments too, huh?
Well, no, this is in the bill.
Yeah.
But there's a couple of...
I know, but you're preparing to make some suggestions here, apparently.
Yes. This, on line 17, except that reciprocal insurance companies, we wish to insert, except that an insurance company, including a reciprocal insurance company. There's stock companies, mutual companies, and reciprocals. And there was some question in some people's mind whether if we said a reciprocal, in other words, we didn't want to be limited solely to a reciprocal. If we could raise the additional funds to create a stock company or a mutual company, we wanted to have that alternative. And it's merely descriptive in nature in that it allows them to choose whether they go reciprocal or whether they go stock company or whether they go mutual. And that would be the only change down through line 24. Then on line 24 it says, for the purpose of this section, aggregate insurance is insurance which provides coverage in the event that the total fund of the, and delete reciprocal, insurance company, including a reciprocal, available to pay claims, delete received, for occurrences of any 1 year is exhausted. And that is in the technical amendment. Now, what these two sections do merely allow the physicians to create a self-insurance company without the necessity of having so much original capitalization as the present law requires, and allows them to raise the level at which they may buy reinsurance. And that's the effect of the bill. The present law requires that you carry reinsurance at 10% of your capital and surplus. At the present time, we can get reinsurance only at the $250,000 level. Therefore, we'd have to have $2.5 million in the kitty to start. In lieu of the $2.5 million kitty to start, we have a plan where we substitute another form of insurance called aggregate insurance, which this bill allows us to take into consideration and determine at what level we can reinsure. And those are the nature of the amendments at that level. On page 11, the bottom line, 30, 31, and 32 should be deleted. That was some of the old language. It allowed the $400,000 limitation to apply only if a doctor were a member of this reciprocal, and that is an error. It should not be that way. So section 3 of that should be totally deleted. The other factor that we asked the committee to consider was the matter of the statute of limitations. One of the problems, and as you as lawyers know in the handling of these cases, is the long tail. You have to collect the premium in 75 to be available to pay claims that may occur as late as 10 years down the line if you deal with the case of a minor. This has been a problem of trying to collect today, in today's economic climate, a fund or a fee or a premium that will be sufficient to go down the line 10 years. And therefore, the tail has been one of the things that has scared away insurance companies because they have to project so far. It's one of the things that frightens us if we go into our self-insurance program. We therefore asked originally that the statute of limitations be limited to 2 years from the date of the negligent act, with the exception of foreign objects, and then it be 1 year from discovery, but not more than five from the date of the act. We also, in this amendment that we have handed in, have put in the original portions of the statute of limitations, which extend it if the doctor fraudulently conceals and misleads the patient so he would be unaware of his cause of action, and then the statute would run 1 year from the date he discovered or should have discovered of the fraudulent concealment.
Mr. Cooney, you haven't put anything in here about minors at all, yet you referred to minors.
Well, the minor bill merely tacks on 5 years.
You haven't said so. You haven't referred to minors.
I'm relying on the case law.
Pardon?
The case law is what I'm relying on. perhaps we should include minors in this and make it remove some of the uncertainty, but there's a case in the last year that indicated that the maximum extension on a minor's claim would be the normal statute limitation, like 2 years plus five.
Well, if it's a birth, damage at birth.
Same thing.
Some of the states are going to age 6, age 10, and so on. You aren't proposing any thing such as that, huh?
I have not proposed a change in the minor statute.
We've got previous changes now. I think that's probably the reason.
It's the 7 years, although in a malpractice it's 10, because you see the malpractice statute now is 2 years from discovery, but no more than five. And then you put your five-year minor on top of that, you can get 10 in a minor's claim. And so this is, I vacillate considerably about the problem of the minor's claim. We did not seek to shorten it in minor's cases. We left it with the common law as it now stands. The only other area that I would point out would be on line 15.
Page 15,
line 3 makes the act applicable for complaints filed on or after this particular date. In reconsidering this, the occurrences probably should be the event, because the insurance has already taken effect and the coverage is there for occurrences up to the effective date of this bill. So in effect, we're not changing anything. You'd be making the damages retroactive for claims that were alive under the old insurance law. And talking to some of the plaintiffs' counsel, they pointed that out to me, and it may be that insofar as the insurance company, that might be a windfall that the committee may not wish to give them. In other words, this should perhaps speak for negligent acts occurring after the enactment date, as opposed to the filing of the complaint, because those that have occurred prior to the filing of the complaint were already under the old existing law and probably covered by some form of insurance, and that time for which a premium has already been collected. I have just a couple of remarks.
Delete line 32 and 33.
I got some more reference to that.
Senator.
What?
I have some reference to that amendment.
Bob has some. He has some testimony.
I have some additional
on.
Testimony.
Well, where are you starting, young fellow?
Why don't you just tell him rapidly that you've suggested deleting the interim committee study?
Suggested deleting this interim committee is contained in here, as it is not funded and it is subject to solely on a voluntary basis. Another bill, House Bill 3017, which is which the House Judiciary Committee has sent to Ways and Means, is currently there, and I would strongly urge that we definitely do need thorough study in this area, and that encouragement to Ways and Means to create an interim committee that will be properly funded so that they can have the proper staff to conduct the studies that are necessary is appropriate. To create a commission that will not be funded, will not be staffed, is not going to do the job that we need to have done. And that's why we propose that. That's right. But if we were to include the funding in this bill, then it's got to go to Ways and Means, and further delay may just totally wipe out the entire bill. There is a bill, House Bill 3017,
Have they had a hearing on it?
I don't believe they have. It just arrived there probably last week.
Are there questions of either Mr. Jarnetty or Mr.
Yes, Madam Senator. First of all, Mr. Jarnetty, would you tell me the number of positions currently insured under which categories in Oregon?
I'm sorry, Senator, I do not have the total number by category. If you will turn to page Oh, excuse me. We have it right here. You will refer to Class 1 in your exhibit material here, the material that I've provided you. The fourth page of the technical material is provided you here. And this is as of November of 1974. Right. Yeah, November 1974.
What are the numbers here? I don't see.
Well, I'm going to cite to you the number of those. I'm giving you the rates on that sheet.
The number of. Table 4, table 5.
All right, Class 1. This table here, Senator.
Well, look at the table.
The rate.
What's the number of it? Table 4?
Table 6.
That's it. You got it.
There are 449 positions in Class 1.
449?
Right. There are 49 in Class 2.
49.
There are 321 in Class 3.
321.
There are 159 in Class 4. There are 202 in Class 5. 322 in Class 6. And there are 31 into another class, which is Class 7, which is a part-time, which is a minor amount, part-time.
How many positions in Oregon do you know that don't have the malpractice?
Very few. The exact number, I can't tell you.
Is there any other insurance company in Oregon writing medical malpractice?
There are two insurance companies in Oregon that are currently writing malpractice insurance. One is St. Paul, which is not writing any new insurance unless Mr. Sharp back here has got some late information for me, and CNA Insurance, which is writing the bulk of it under a contract with the Oregon Medical Association that expires in 11 months.
Now, are these that you gave me, are those the current CNA?
Those are the current rates, effective May 1 of this year.
All right, are they the current numbers in the CNA coverage?
As of November, Senator.
All right, now how
I
many...
I do not have the current numbers.
As of November, now, how many Oregon physicians wrote under St. Paul?
You'd have to talk to Mr. Sharp. I think he said close to 900.
900. Now, what... Is there someone here that can tell me the number of positions in each of the categories under St. Paul?
Mr. Sharp might be able to. I cannot.
Now, is there just two companies? Are you saying there are just two companies that write malpractice insurance, medical malpractice in Oregon, CNA and St. Paul?
That's correct.
There are no others?
There may. Lloyd's of London may write one or two policies. Someone else may, but that's it.
All right. What's your total on these? Did you total these up here?
This is a total of 1,578. This goes back to 1974. This is November 30, 1974's experience.
All right. Now, how many licensed physicians are there in Oregon?
3,500.
All right. Now, I got 1,578, St. Paul Rice 900.
That's correct.
That's 2,400, a little less than 2,500, and yet there are 3,500 physicians.
A number of them are retired. A lot of them that are licensed in the state, Senator, are practicing outside of the state of Oregon, do not practice here. They keep an active license, but do not practice here. Then there's Kaiser Permanente, a couple of hundred physicians who are self-insured up to a certain amount, but there's representatives of Kaiser who can explain their procedure at this time. There are a number of faculty members at the school who do not practice off the hill and are insured under the medical school's master policy through the University of Oregon system, which will expire October 1 and not be renewed.
All right, now would you tell me the type of physician, let's see, or is that somewhere else? What is the type of physician who fits Class 1?
If you'll read at the bottom of the Table 6, you'll find a classification for all of them, Senator.
All right, now would you tell me, in terms of percentage, can you give me the figures of what percentage, actual percentage, of income on the average, the premium on Class 1 represents for Oregon physicians? the average...
What percentage of... First of all, tell me, what is the average income of physicians in Class 1 in Oregon?
I can't tell you, sir.
Do you have any idea?
I think anything I would guess that would be inappropriate.
We have not done any
specific studies of what their gross income is that we can reveal to public information.
Yeah, but you testified as to percentages.
That's right.
It seems to me you've opened the subject up. If we're to accept your testimony as to percentages of income, we ought to know what the incomes are.
Sorry, Senator, we got the percentages from the physicians themselves.
Are you saying that you will refuse to supply us with the...
I can't supply you, sir, something that I do not have.
Well, you get them for us. You represent the doctors, don't you?
Yeah, but I'm sorry. I probably wouldn't be able to get them during the time that the Oregon legislature is in session.
You're asking us to make a decision based on inadequate facts that are probably available to you. Have you tried to get these income figures?
I have no reason for it. I'm giving you national averages. I do not have the figures. I can't give you anything as far as Oregon is concerned.
Aren't there medical journals that supply economic, I believe there's an addition, isn't there?
Medical economics supplies you general information by regions, by the United States, but...
Why don't you tell me that? What's the figure? What's
I do not have them, sir, on my top of my head. I couldn't give you the figures.
Could you get them for me tomorrow?
Are you talking about gross income? Are you talking about net income? What are you talking about?
I'm talking about gross and net.
Gross and net, well... You're asking for a big order, Senator. I can't give you that. I don't have it.
What do you think you're asking for here? You're asking for a limit on recovery based in part upon... Where is that statement? I saw it here in your testimony where you said that something about premiums are around 10%, and I wonder if you say that premiums are up to 10%. I marked it on one of
I think I used the word approaching 10%.
Approaching 10%. How in the world do you know that if you don't have any figures?
I got the figures from the physicians as to what percentage they felt their new premium would be to their gross income.
Senator Cook, I'd like for you to pursue your questioning to the extent that you desire, but we do have an awful lot of people who are still waiting to testify, and I'd appreciate very much if you take this up with Mr. Gennetti.
Well, Madam Chairman, I think that they should provide us with those figures, certainly recent figures, because of these results. Particularly, and I know I marked it down when they come in and talk about percentages. Now, Mr. Cooney, someone here has said tonight that there were 12 awards of $1 million over the last 12 months in California. Can you tell me what the total amount of insurance payments were for the year 1974 versus the total amount of premiums collected from medical doctors in California?
No, I cannot.
As a matter of fact,
yeah,
isn't that...
That was Representative Fulmeyer's office.
Okay. All right. I believe it's in the, I don't know if it was, in the testimony here somewhere. I've got it, I looked at it, it's written. Don't you think, really, when whoever it is makes a statement like that, that doesn't really mean anything unless you know the total amount of payments on claims and the total amount of premiums?
I referenced, Senator, was the fact that balloon awards in excess of $1 million are occurring rather more frequently throughout the country, and that it's is a monthly occurrence in California now. On the average, it occurs once a month.
Yeah, but aren't there, how many million people are there in California?
I do not know. Here's one thing, Senator Cook. I appreciate your criticism of the insurance industry, and I know there are areas in which we all have doubts about some of the things they've done. But I think it would be, you have to worry beyond just the premium expense factor and what the insurance company is doing with the money, as opposed to what in God's name are we going to do, whether those insurance companies are good, bad, or indifferent, and if they're not here. That's the primary concern. And if the matter of criticism is directed toward insurance companies, that doesn't solve the immediate problem of whether they're doing right or wrong, that it's going to leave a profession uninsured.
Well, that isn't my point at all. My point is, I think there are 20 million people in California. 25 million? All right. Now, if we had $1 million award in Oregon with a population of 2 million, well, that might be frightening. But we're talking about $1 million award a month in a state with a population of 25 million, if that's correct, figure's correct, 12 times as many people as are here. And so, again, I question, the statements are made, they may be true, but they are misleading unless they're made in context in talking about how much was paid in premium to insurance companies in California, and then what percentage of those premiums were paid out in awards. Obviously, the probability of $1 million award increases if you have 10 times as many malpractice cases, because there are 10 times as many people. It's just a question of probability, isn't it? Rather than proving anything other than the fact that there are 10 to 15 times as many people in California, therefore one would expect you would occasionally have a higher award.
My point, Senator, was that they are occurring far more frequently.
But you haven't presented facts. What data do we have from before that would prove that? Except your bald statement. Do you have any data showing us how many? Let's talk about real dollars. And of course, we have to recognize inflation. Do you have any data at all to demonstrate that in real dollars, I would have Dave Klemper from the Revenue Committee here to be talking about this, but in real dollars, that the size of verdict in malpractice cases increased in 1974 over 73?
I will get you that data.
I'd like to see that.
I will get it for you.
Are there other questions? Thank you both very much for all the information. We have more people signed up than we can possibly, either the committee or you waiting to testify, can stand tonight. So I'd like to be a little selective in those that we hear, and would ask those of you who are around this place frequently to be patient and perhaps testify at another time. And George Burney, I presume you'll do that.
I'd be excused in that.
You may be excused. Yes. And I wonder, Pete Fleshner, what I would like to hear tonight is anyone who has proposed amendments to this bill. I'd like to get all the amendments out. I know we, from Kaiser, we have proposed amendments, and I want to hear something from the plaintiff's attorneys. I don't know which one wants to represent the plaintiff's attorneys, but I think we'd better hear from at least one of you.
How late are you going to go?
I'm going to go till I hear these people who have, I'm going to hear from Kaiser, I'm going to hear, Pete, do you have amendments to propose?
No, I really just want to offer support from the Oregon Association of Hospitals. I don't have any changes.
Well, I guarantee you we'll have another hearing and we'll have an opportunity to have, if you want to make proposals, you
Thank
certainly
you.
May.
Has anybody offered the Kaiser amendment?
Jay, let's have the Kaiser amendment, and then Dick Noble. I'd like to hear from you after that, if that's, and then we'll see what time it is.
Madam Chairman, I'm Jay Owen, representing Kaiser Health Plan. I'd like to introduce Scott Fleming, our regional manager, who has been legal counsel to Kaiser Health Plan and has spent 2 years as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Health Planning in Washington, D.C., and I would like to speak to our amendments and to the bill in favor of the concept of 2647.
Okay, the amendments have been passed out, so we have them.
First, we do wish to express our support for the bill and our support for the comments and suggestions that were made by the Oregon Medical Association here this evening. I very much regret the necessity to present this amendment to the bill, because we made a considerable effort to reach agreement with the Oregon Medical Association on this amendment since the bill was under consideration in the House, but were unable to do so. We do support the bill. We are concerned that the bill takes the entire principles of medical ethics of the American Medical Association and makes it the statutory law of the state of Oregon. We have serious questions about such a delegation to a private association. Notwithstanding that, we support that for the most part, because for the most part we believe that the principles of ethics do bear on significant aspects of the malpractice situation. However, the principles of medical ethics of the American Medical Association also bear on socioeconomic matters. They bear on a variety of matters that are not directly related to the health and safety of patients, nor are they directly related to charges of physicians for medical services, which are occasionally a source of malpractice problems. Accordingly, we attempted to work out mutually satisfactory language with the Oregon Medical Association to indicate that the socioeconomics of medical care are not an aspect that would lead to unprofessional conduct charges. Being unable to do so, we did our best to devise an amendment along those lines, which is the one we have presented to the committee, and we urge its adoption.
Okay, thank you. Other questions?
The capitalized language in the amendment we have submitted would be wording added to the bill that they have submitted. The intent of this language is to indicate that insofar as the standards of unprofessional conduct of Oregon are concerned, the principles of medical ethics would be incorporated insofar as they relate to the health and safety of patients or to fees charged by physicians to their patients, but that other aspects of the principles of medical ethics, which get into the socioeconomics of medicine, to some extent into the politics of medicine, would not become part of the statutory law of the state of Oregon.
There's always been a basic disagreement on socialized medicine, or that's the Kaiser, and is this back to that same old?
It has its roots in the possibility that the principles of medical ethics might be utilized as an approach to control aspects of medical care that have nothing to do with protecting patients.
Over the years, we've solved the racial problems and all this kind of stuff. I wish the two groups would
Well, sir, I can only say that we did our level best to accomplish that purpose.
Norm, if they did, we wouldn't have a job.
Well, this has been going on like these other things that we've compromised out this year that are just damn foolish district of not having some kind of
Any other statements, Jay?
No, that's all.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much. We've got your amendment. Dick Noble? I think a couple of members have gone out for a smoke. They couldn't stand it much longer.
I wouldn't mind joining them. If you... Because it's 9:30 and because a number of amendments have been submitted tonight that I don't know anything about, which I gather substantially changes, I'd be perfectly willing to come back after I've seen their amendments and I could submit our amendments tonight, but I'm ready to proceed whichever way you want to go.
I think you're right on target, and the fact I was going to wait to see what you were going to say and suggest to ask you if you'd seen the OMA's amendments.
No, I have not. I might, rather than getting into a dissertation about what I think about the bill and what I think the solution would be, I could hand in the amendments and try to briefly explain the significance of those amendments and come back at a subsequent hearing. And
we've got a time problem, which you're well aware of, I guess, from being around here, that we've got a few weeks, and this bill is not going to be an easy one. We're going to have to consider, I guess, it subject by subject by subject as we go through the amendments. How soon could you go through the amendments and confer with your fellow attorneys and be prepared to make some suggestions?
Anytime. We could do it tomorrow, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, anytime the committee indicates.
Well, you certainly could be ready by next Monday.
Sure. Well, let's see, next Monday I think it's Memorial Day. But
oh, we work.
You do? That'd be fine. Because I don't have anything, I don't have any conflict on my doctor. I guarantee I can be here.
At least the president hasn't indicated he's going to give us a vacation yet. So
we're
going to work Saturday too. I think that in view of the time and the fact that we're getting a little rummy, and most of us sitting here have 8 o'clock committee meetings in the morning, that I will, and there's no point in you making statements about this bill when it's liable to be changed by these amendments. So if you would go through them, be prepared, and it will be no later than Monday. And if it's to be sooner, you certainly will be notified.
All right. Could I, at this time, hand in the amendments for any member's consideration that wants to consider them before?
These are ones that you had prepared before you knew there were going to be others?
Yes.
Is that correct?
Uh-huh. And just there are multiple copies. So there aren't as many amendments as you might gather by looking at the thickness of
what
I'm handing
you. Well, why don't we hang on? All right. Why don't we hold on to these until you have decided if these are in fact the ones that you're going to ultimately propose, or if there's going to be any changes in them. We'll identify them. They're identified in the both. Okay. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Keep you informed of who we'll be meeting. Dr. Gruber from Toledo, Oregon, who said he'd come back, but he has to drive quite a ways to get here, so take your testimony tonight.
Thank you, Senator, for the opportunity, because I will be driving back yet tonight. I'm not going to testify as far as facts and figures are concerned, because many of them I've heard in the committee meeting, the Judiciary Committee in the House, and there are people better able than I am to bring those to the committee. My purpose here is to present the viewpoints of a physician, not presenting any other viewpoints. I'm one of those less than perfect people, as I said at the Judiciary Committee, who are practicing a less than perfect system under less than perfect conditions. And whenever I see a malpractice suit, and I don't like the term malpractice, it has connotations outside the term of negligence, but whenever I see one of those, I'm one of those who say, thank God, you know, there but for the grace of God go I. And I'm sure that those of you who are attorneys and in other fields have similar feelings when somebody else makes a mistake. I'm sure in all of our professional lives we make many mistakes, and we just hope that we can rectify them before they become serious ones and prevent any greater harm or greater injury. There's been some discussion both tonight and also at the House Judiciary Committee meeting as to how this is going to affect the individual physician and what benefit it's going to have to the patient. I'd like to testify some to that. Just in March, as a result of the increase in fees for malpractice insurance, which in my case went up over $3,000, which was almost a 200% increase. And I'm just a general practitioner practicing in a rural area. I do all sorts of medical practice, including delivery babies, some surgery and so forth, some orthopedics. There are two other physicians, younger physicians, who just came to the area 2 and 3 years ago. One of them has just announced that he is no longer going to do obstetrical care because of the malpractice situation. The second one is considering dropping obstetrical care. Two other older physicians in Newport, Oregon have retired. In my own practice, I have raised my fees $1.50 per office visit to cover the increase in malpractice. I've increased obstetrical fees $75 to prorate the increase in malpractice over the work which I do in a year. I have dropped some of the surgery which I used to do, which I felt I was quite competent at, and now I either send them to Corvallis 50 miles away or rely upon a surgeon who practices mainly out of Lincoln City but will come down to Toledo if necessary. The increase in malpractice insurance has changed the emphasis of my practice radically and other physicians in our area. It is affecting patients considerably because of the increase in fees. And I know Senator Cook wants to know what the amount of the malpractice is to the income. I can say in my practice, my malpractice amounts to about 12 to 13% of my net income.
Is that before or after? In other words, is it a figure equivalent to
my
12%?
I don't mind saying what my before tax income ranges between 30,000 and about 35,000-36,000 a year. My malpractice runs better than $4,000. Now, one of the reasons why the amount is not germane as compared to income is because different practices have much higher grosses but may not have any greater net. Some doctors may have 3 and 4 people working for them, other people just having 1 person working for them, so that they may have equal grosses but their nets may be greater. So it's very difficult to say to what extent it does affect it. It is a business part of practice, and all expenses are passed on to the patient. No doctor that I know of is going to pay anywhere from $3,000 to $8,000 out of his pocket and not pass it on to the patient as the cost of doing business. So any increase in expense, whether it's increase in pay to our employees or anything else, is passed on and does affect the patient. But I'm more concerned about it than that. If malpractice insurance is not available at a reasonable cost, what has been said about older doctors getting out of practice and younger doctors not going into practice, and especially not going into practice in rural communities, where the risk is greater because you don't have the constant availability of specialist care and consultation. I found it in young doctors who are coming into Lincoln County and have come in to look around it. They are quite concerned about being at risk more and more, and they are just not taking on the kind of work that general practice has to do if you're going to serve a rural area. So that, to me, is the availability of the insurance. And if it's not available at a reasonable cost, a new doctor coming in, practicing any of the professions, has to start paying that fee right off the bat. It's not something he pays after he's been in practice 3 or 4 years. A young surgeon, new surgeon coming into Lincoln County, will have to bungle up his first quarter of premiums, which amounts to about $3,000, before he even does his first surgery. That's a problem. That's an economic problem which is going to reflect itself on the availability of medical care to the people of Oregon. And I think that's as much a problem as the actual dollar value. An extra dollar and a half maybe to the patient for an office visit isn't going to hurt them that much. But it's going to be that they're not going to get the care which they have been accustomed to getting. So those are my concerns. I think I ought to say that the bill that was presented to the Judiciary Committee had a $250,000 limit on it, and I think that was alluded to in an earlier testimony. And it was my testimony there that said that I felt that if there was going to be a limit, it should be a limit that at least could be held for a few years, rather than getting a $250,000 limit and then having to amend it each time we come around 2 years from now. And from the experience and from what I know of the problem, $400,000, I felt, was something that we could live with for a few years. It may be greater than what we would like as physicians, but still it'll protect 99.9% of the public, because there are very few of them that will go that high. And it's high enough to protect that occasional person, but it's not so great that it's going to penalize all the other patients that should be benefiting from that care. There is one slight technical amendment, the word amendment, which bothers me, and that's that on page 11, line 5, where it says the plaintiff shall not recover more than a total amount of $400,000 for both his special and general damages. It's my feeling that could be interpreted and read that $400,000 could be applied to each of those items instead of including both. And to clarify that, I would think that that should be amount of $400,000 including both special and general damages, which would make that meaning more clear. It's also, there is some problem as far as the contingency fee or the reasonable fees, and again, this has been alluded to before, and it's my feeling that there is some problem in whether that reasonable fee should be on top of the award or not. If it were on top of the award, then I can see a problem of encouraging small suits, not because they have validity, but a $1,000 suit would be pretty easy to get through a jury. And if there is reasonable attorney's fees of $2,000 on top of that, which could easily happen from my experience in using attorneys, I can see a lot of these small suits going, and the plaintiff will succeed on a $1,000 case in most cases. I don't see many juries turning down $1,000, $2,000, $5,000 awards. And I'm a little concerned that what that problem is going to have, that a reasonable attorney's fees on top of the award is going to engender a lot of cases which would not and should not come to trial. The main reason that I wanted to be here tonight and emphasize is that this does definitely affect the practicing physician. I could have had more physicians from our area and from the Corvallis area here. I just learned about this committee meeting Saturday morning, and so I came up because I take Mondays off, and I came up to testify today. But I'm sure that we would have no problem getting other physicians to testify similarly to what I have, is the effect it has on their practice.
We were told by the OMA that they could turn out this room many, many times over.
Yes, I agreed with them that masses of people are not the problem, because the stories would be similar.
Are there questions of Dr. Gruber?
Yes.
You speak for those as for your practitioners, the big practitioner, and not for the OMA.
That's correct. So
you don't support then the technical amendments that proposed here tonight that Mr. Cooney did not go into in depth. He only went into an apportionment, and part of it was to receive back to what the original bill was of $250,000 of the true economic loss. That would be 80% of a patient's loss of earnings up to $1,000. And these are things that made me say, the thing that I did that really, in a sense, sort of triggered me, that it looked like the three-way compensation bill, the way the thing is written here, to pay funeral expenses up to $1,000. Some of these things are preposterous in today's world. Now, you don't support those, do you?
I testified at the House committee that I thought some of those were not necessary in the bill. I feel that an overall limitation is better than going into some of that, but I have not seen what he passed out tonight, so I can't.
He didn't speak to them.
I have not seen them, sir. I will get a copy, and I will look at them.
Other questions? Thank you, Dr. Cooper.
Thank you for allowing me.
Appreciate you driving a long way. I have one other person who is listed as plaintiff's attorney, Jim Griswold.
Well, I think, Madam Chairman, it might be best if I were to wait until after all the amendments are in, and then I can speak about those.
All right, and you don't have any proposed yourself tonight?
No, I have
tonight,
no proposed.
So that we get them all together.
Yeah.
All right, good. You'll be informed next meeting. We're adjourned.